From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. You've been listening to Thrive with Morella. And now we're moving into the 3 o'clock hour with Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Martin Puchner, whose new book is The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization, published by Random House. Martin Puchner is the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of Drama and of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University. His prize-winning books cover subjects from philosophy to the arts, and his best-selling six-volume Norton Anthology of World Literature and his Harvard X MOOC, Massive Open Online Course, have brought 4,000 years of literature to students across the globe. He lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The Written World is the story of how literature shaped world history in 16 acts, from Alexander the Great and the Iliad to Don Quixote and Harry Potter. In this groundbreaking book, Martin Puchner leads us on a remarkable journey through time and around the globe to reveal the powerful role stories and literature have played in creating the world that we have today. Puchner introduces us to numerous visionaries as he explores 16 foundational texts selected from more than 4,000 years of world literature and reveals how writing has inspired the rise and fall of empires and nations, the spark of philosophical and political ideas, and the birth of religious beliefs. Indeed, literature has touched the lives of generations and changed the course of history. At the heart of this book are works, some long lost and rediscovered, that have shaped civilization. The first written masterpiece, The Epic of Gilgamesh, Ezra's Hebrew Bible, the teachings of Buddha, Confucius, Socrates, and Jesus. And the first great novel in world literature, The Tale of Genji, written by a Japanese woman known as Murasaki. Visiting Baghdad, Puchner tells of Scheherazade and the stories of 1001 Nights. And in the Americas, we watch the astonishing survival of the Maya epic, Popol Vuh. Cervantes, who invented the modern novel, battles pirates both real when he is taken prisoner and literary when a fake sequel to Don Quixote is published. We learn of Benjamin Franklin's pioneering work as a media entrepreneur. We watch Goethe discover world literature in Sicily and follow the rise in influence of the Communist Manifesto. We visit Troy, Pergamum, and China, and we speak with Nobel laureates Derek Walcott in the Caribbean and Orhan Pamuk in Istanbul, as well as the wordsmiths of the oral epic Sunjata in West Africa. Throughout The Written World, Puchner's delightful narrative also chronicles the inventions, writing technologies, the printing process, the book itself, that have shaped religion, politics, commerce, people, and history. In a book that Elaine Scarry has praised as unique and spellbinding, Puchner shows how literature turned our planet into a written world. Martin Puchner and I began our conversation by discussing how he found a vision for this book, which covers so much history and story. You'll hear my question that got us started. I hope you enjoy our conversation. The book encompasses a lot of information, history, literature, the lives of the authors, their teaching methods, and the media used to convey their stories. So I wondered if we could start out by talking about how this project started for you, how it took shape, and when it was that you really knew what it would look like as a book.
Yeah, it was a pretty long process. In some sense, it started about 12 years ago when I began working on the Norton Anthology of World Literature, a big six-volume anthology that started with the invention of writing and ended up 6,000 pages later in the early 20th century. And I am the general editor of that anthology. I worked with a large team of experts.
Yeah.
But what really blew my mind in the work on it was that for the first time, really in my life, I'd been teaching and studying literature for decades, but for the first time in my life, really, I was forced to assemble the big picture. Mm-hmm. Really, what does the long story of literature look like, all 4,000 years of it? And I was stunned by the basic things I actually didn't know about it. How often was writing developed? what were the key technologies that drove the history of literature forward? What was the interaction between those technologies and the stories that made it into writing and that took hold and survived? And so the work on the anthology and working with all these experts really step by step led me to this process. And it was at some point during that period, during that time, during that process, that I decided, you know, I think I should turn this into a book because people in literary studies tend to be very specialized. I used to be an expert in 19th and 20th century literature, mostly European and American, which is great, and there are good reasons for specialization. But I felt that there was something missing, and that was the bigger picture, and that's what I'm trying to capture.
Okay, all right. Now, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the decision that you made to travel to many of the places where these literary works were conceived and realized. And I don't think you went to every single place, but it sounds like you did a lot of traveling around this book.
I did, because here I found myself thinking about the way, not just how literature developed, but also how it shaped history. That was my question. You know, the one thought behind that was that I felt like I wanted to write a kind of clandestine defense of literature, but I didn't want to just say why no one cares about literature anymore. I wanted to show it in action, and I wanted to show its power. So, thinking about that, I felt like at some point, since I'm talking about literature and the world, I should get up from my armchair and actually visit some of the places I was writing about, get a sense of how they were shaped by literature. And of course, also in the case of living authors, because I was always interested in how even ancient texts get adapted and revived by contemporary authors, to meet with them whenever I could, whenever they would be happy to meet with me and talk to them as well. So that, I think that was the main motivation. This was also a period when I was traveling a lot anyway, and so whenever I went to some part of the world that seemed to have some bearing on what I was writing about, I went out of my way to go there and talk to people and get a sense of the place.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So did part of your work involve a sabbatical, or were you traveling for other reasons?
A bit of both. In some cases, I was traveling for other reasons because, you know, I may have been invited to give a talk.
Okay.
In one case, I was doing a travel. I was leading a group of Harvard alumni from Istanbul down the Aegean coast. In some cases, this was also a period when I was filming footage for a online course on world literature.
Right.
So that sometimes took me to different parts of the world. And sometimes I traveled for that purpose. So some of this was over the summer or during break, shorter trips during the semester on occasion, and some during sabbatical. Yeah. So this was, you know, this is a process of many years, of 5, 6, 7 years, in some sense even longer, that led me to do the reading and thinking, but also the traveling that fed into the book.
And it sounds like you were working on other things at the same time, so of course it would take longer because this wasn't your only project. Is that correct?
That's right. Well, yeah. You know, in the beginning, I didn't even know that it was a book necessarily I was working in the early years. I thought this was just the sort of background work for the anthology, and that then morphed into a book, a freestanding book. And, you know, I should say on the topic of travel that at some point I even thought about writing the book as a travel book.
Mm-hmm.
I then decided that wasn't quite enough for my purpose. It was really this big picture history I was writing. But as you say, the travel aspect, I think, still stayed in the book to some extent, and it became part of the method and part of a kind of through line to some extent.
Yeah, and it was fun because it was part of the story. You know, your story of writing the book was part of the story, and I have a question about that later, but that was fun to read. So early on in the introduction, you refer to the four stages of literature that made themselves clear to you as you worked, and you offered a very succinct and understandable description of these four stages, so I'm hoping this is not too big a question, but you mentioned scribes, challengers to the foundational texts that were controlled by the scribes, and then the emergence of individual authors, and then finally mass production and mass literacy as four stages of the development of world literature. And I just wonder if we can have a short discussion of these four, because that was a very succinct description of something I found fascinating, which of course you go in much more detail in the book. But can you just talk a little bit about those four stages?
Absolutely. And it's really these kind of patterns that I found myself really interested in as I was assembling this bigger picture. So one of the things that I was really struck by is that when we think of literature, we think of individual authors who are maybe professionals who create individual stories,
right,
who own those stories, and then who sell them on some kind of marketplace. And if you look at the deep history of literature, you realize just how recent the emergence of individual authors were, that for much of the 4,000-year-long history of literature, texts were assembled by scribes or editors. They were somehow culled from oral traditions, mm-hmm, or from other texts and then reassembled, cut and pasted, arranged and rearranged. And these longer collections, such as the Hebrew Bible, or epic stories, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, emerge often from layers and layers and layers of texts over long periods of time. In some cases, the Homeric epics would be an example of that. The transition happens more quickly, and maybe by one scribe or a handful of scribes, but the norm, I would say, is these layered texts that a lot of people work on, and for lack of a better word, we can call them scribes or editors or collators, aggregators, I suppose we would call them today. It's interesting how some of these early functions of literature are returning in our own moment. So that's sort of the it's from the handiwork of these scribes that two important types of texts emerge in my story, the early epics, like the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Homeric epics, mm-hmm, and then as a kind of version of that, the idea, and that's really important for me, of sacred scripture. Mm-hmm. I describe how in Mesopotamia, when writing first develops, it develops for very mundane purposes, namely accounting purposes, the work of tax collectors, the first city bureaucrats. But then after a couple of hundred years, some of these accountants use their technique to do something very different, namely to write down oral stories like the Epic of Gilgamesh. But if you think about this mundane origin, it becomes sort of surprising that at some point, some of these stories would be actually declared sacred, as happened with the Hebrew Bible and other texts, a hugely important idea that I think still holds our world in its grip with different religious and political texts that different people consider as sacred or untouchable, or in any case, important guidelines for their lives.
Right.
And then, for me, perhaps the most fascinating moment in that story is when what I call these charismatic teachers emerge in some of the most literate places of the ancient world, such as China, South Asia, India, Greece, and the Middle East. And these charismatic teachers introduce new ideas that became the foundation of world religions and philosophical traditions. And I'm talking about teachers such as Confucius in China, the Buddha in India, Socrates in Greece, and Jesus in the Near East. And later, Muhammad is another one of these figures. Now, what they have in common, and I was really struck by this, is that none of them wrote a single word.
Right.
So we have, in the midst of these thriving, developing, growing writing cultures, these skeptics, these Luddites, these figures who insist on face-to-face teaching, on this live interaction with their students and followers. But then, of course, the inevitable happens, and they die, and now their students are faced with this dilemma. Should they honor their teacher's rejection of writing, or should they use writing in order to take down their teacher's words and deeds? And ultimately, sooner or later, that's what happens. They use writing, they produce these new kinds of texts that are more vivid, that are more dialogic, they are dramatic philosophical dialogues or vivid anecdotes about these teachers, and they become a new kind of text in literary world.
Yeah.
And then I describe how new technologies, especially paper, gradually lower the cost of literature, and that allows new entrants into the literary world. And what emerges from that are much more popular kinds of stories. And I use as an example the 1001 Nights, the Arabian Nights. The stories themselves come from many other story collections. There's this whole network of story collections that emerges in, now we are sort of in the late antiquity, Middle Ages, become very popular, dominant genres, and then feed into, after the development of print in China, and then redeveloped, reinvented by Gutenberg in Northern Europe, this era of mass literacy and mass production that turns these story collections slowly into new popular genres like the novel.
Yeah.
So that's sort of this is a rough sketch, yeah, of the history I tell. So it's different people, such as scribes, these charismatic teachers, editors, and finally, individual authors.
Yeah.
It's different types of texts, foundational epics, sacred texts, then story collections, and then the texts of these master teachers written by students, and then story collections and novels, different types of texts. And that also means different types of readers.
Right, yeah. And a fifth category that you didn't talk about, and maybe because it's so new, is the digital age and writing going to like electronic works. I was curious about that. You speak about it later, but you didn't call it one of these four stages.
I could have. It is certainly the fifth stage. I think you're absolutely right about it. And in some sense, the entire book was another a motivation for it, is an attempt to grapple with what's going on around it. It's clear that we are living through one of those revolutions in writing technologies. It's clear that that is having profound effects on how we communicate with words, how we tell stories, who tells stories, how we read them, how we distribute them. And so the entire book, in some sense, is an attempt to look at the prehistory of our current moment, to look at what happened at earlier moments when new technologies came along and changed the written world.
Right.
And so I think you're absolutely right. There's no doubt in my mind that we are on the cusp of this fifth stage, if you will. And I won't try to make too many predictions about it, but we can speculate about it in a sense based on that prehistory,
yeah,
I tell in the book.
Yeah. Now, one of the stories that you tell of scribes laying down an oral tradition is the anonymous scribe that wrote the Iliad in the Greek alphabet, and it was offered sort of as song and not story, which was really interesting. And then you write quite a bit about Alexander's love of the Iliad and how that work influenced him, and I wonder if we can just talk a little bit about Alexander and his love of the Iliad and what that might have done to world history.
Yeah, for me, the Alexander story really, in some sense, captures what I'm trying to do in the book, which is why I start with it, even though it's technically not the earliest of the episodes
right.
I talk about. It was clear to me that I wanted to talk about the Homeric epics. They're such an influential pair of texts. But I didn't just want to write about these texts and how they came about. I wanted to write about how they changed the world, how they survived, and how they, in a sense, made it into world literature. And that's where the story of Alexander the Great came in. Alexander the Great, like all Greek-speaking people of his time, those who learned how to read and write did so by studying the Homeric epics. And so he grew up with these stories, in particular stories of the Iliad, a story about a Greek force sailing over to Asia Minor, to Troy, and laying siege to that city. And it was really that story that lodged in his mind, so that when he started his Asian campaign, it became very clear to me that he was basically reenacting the stories of the Iliad.
Yeah.
The first place he goes to is Troy, even though it has absolutely no military importance. He literally reenacts scenes from the Trojan War, and he carries his copy of the Iliad with him for his entire campaign. He sleeps on it every night. And so that's so clear and it's so fascinating. So we have one way of literature influencing the world, namely by really shaping the minds of important historical figures. But there's a second part to the story that became equally important, because Alexander, through his campaign, really makes Greek a more modern, a simpler form of Greek called Koine Greek, Common Greek, the lingua franca of a huge part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
He creates different garrisons and cities, often called after himself, very modestly, Alexandria, in different parts of the world, including, of course, most famously, the Alexandria in Egypt. What's often at the center of these Greek settlements and cities are two institutions. One is theaters, and the other is libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And both, of course, are in some sense ultimately devoted to the Homeric epics, the libraries, because this is where copies of the Homeric epics and commentaries and so on and so on them were housed and produced. And of course, the theaters were there in part to enact stories from the Homeric worlds. So what became clear to me is that not only did the Iliad influence Alexandria in his conquest of parts of Asia, but in a sense, Alexander gave back to the Iliad by turning Greek language of the Iliad and the Odyssey into a world language, and by creating the infrastructure, including libraries and theaters, that really made this text thrive.
Yeah.
These are the two ways, in a way, readers, of course, get influenced by the stories they read, but what's equally important is sort of the infrastructure, the technology, again, the institutions that allow texts to survive and thrive.
Yeah. Now, before we move on past Alexander, I wanted to just mention that he reminded me, and I never ever thought I would make this comparison ever in my life, but he reminded me of a more contemporary leader, because he decided to adopt Eastern protocol and require his comrades to prostrate themselves before him and swear loyalty to him, and they did so very grudgingly, and it reminded me of someone contemporary who has done that.
Yeah. Indeed. Indeed.
Yes. But that was a very different time and history. Let's talk a little bit about the Epic of Gilgamesh. I was fascinated to read about the discoverer of Nineveh, Layard, who I did not know anything about. Maybe I'm saying his name wrong. Is it Layard?
It's Layard.
Layard.
Yeah, you're
so
right.
I was interested to hear he wasn't an archaeologist, and he just kind of was a curious fellow who stumbled upon this huge find.
Yes, I mean, many of the great discoverers of the 19th century were, I mean, amateur. They were adventurous. They were travelers. They were, you know, men of means with ideas and the wherewithal of turning these ideas into actual digs and excavations. Layard was actually pretty responsible in the way he proceeded. Schliemann, the discoverer of Troy, a little later, was much worse. He just basically bulldozed his way through these layers of Troy. And in case of Schliemann, and I went, you can still see the trenches he dug in the city. I mean, on the one hand, we have to be grateful to Schliemann. He put Troy back on the actual map, of course, and it was his sort of can-do attitude that is responsible for it. But at the same time, as he discovered Troy, he in a sense destroyed a lot of valuable historical information by just, you know, not really knowing what he was doing. Laird, as I said, was not as bad. But he was, of course, all of these figures then immediately packed up what they could find and transported their finds in crates, sometimes secretly, sometimes openly, sometimes by bribing local officials off to Berlin, or in the case of Laird, to the British Museum, which is where his loot is today. So, you know, some ambiguous figures, but fascinating figures nevertheless, and of course historically crucial ones.
Yeah, it brings to mind Indiana Jones, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's what Indiana Jones is based on, based on these figures.
Right. Okay, I'm just thinking it must just kill the archaeologist that he, you know, did this without being an archaeologist. I suppose that's how the whole discipline grew, though, based on all of these finds.
That's exactly it. And in response to the destruction that some of these people also wreaked.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
So one story that you relay in the book, these are all, of course, much larger stories than we're able to address here. But anyway, you talk about Ezra, who brought the Hebrew scriptures directly to the people. And that was a very interesting story to read about, because it brings up a common theme in history throughout, I think, many, many religions, not just one, that of priests and scribes sort of retaining control of people by retaining control of the texts that they were entrusted with. And Ezra sort of brings it to the people. And I wonder if we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a very nice way of formulating it, I think. And it's really, for me, the origin of this idea of declaring some texts sacred. And as I said earlier, it's such a familiar idea now to us. I think we can't, as you say also, I think it's almost impossible for us to think of religion, to imagine a religion without some sort of sacred text behind it. And that's true not just of the so-called religions of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also of Buddhism and Hinduism and really almost the Jains have sacred scripture. But as like all things, this idea had to be invented. And I think it was first invented in that scene I describe, namely when the scribe Ezra, who had lived in Babylonian exile, Jerusalem had been destroyed, and many Jews living there had been forced into Babylonian exile. Mm-hmm. So here they were in Babylon, in Mesopotamia, the place where writing was first invented, and which was sort of the center of writing culture. And this is precisely the milieu in which Ezra grew up, and he became an official, so to speak, certified scribe. And it was also in Babylonian exile that the stories the Jews had been writing down became more important, because here they were in exile without a temple, without a king. So in some sense, the scriptures were all that was holding that exile community together.
Mm-hmm.
So then Ezra gathers a group of followers, and they return, they get permission to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the city, to rebuild the city wall, to rebuild the temple, and to reinstitute Judaism as a temple practice. But they bring this scribal culture back with them as well. And this is when Ezra stages this very carefully planned scene he constructs a wooden platform. He gets up on the platform. He calls everybody together. And then he takes these scrolls on which he had written and assembled the stories of the Jews, and he holds up these scrolls and demands that the people worship them as if they were a god.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, is the scene that, in a sense, captures this idea of sacred scripture,
mm-hmm.
that now writing is used not just to write down and capture and fix stories about gods, but that it is itself an object of worship, that it is divine, that it is what we call scripture. And as you say, this idea has become hugely influential, I think more influential than we sometimes realize, not just with Judaism and Christianity and Islam, but with really almost all religions.
Yeah, and I think one of the threads that is just so effective in your book that runs through this, and this is the beginning of one of these threads, is that the fact that people didn't have access to these scriptures before had in part to do, I'm sure, with education and with the ability for them to actually read the texts. And I think that all of that is tied up with the media on which these, or the technology that's available for conveying information. And, you know, these were on, I'm trying to remember, was it parchment or was it on like sheepskin, but you know, there was no paper and ink at that point. And so, of course, as the technology changes, then people have more access and the education changes, I would assume.
Absolutely. And education is, it's not a main theme, but it is sort of a sub-theme. And it's interesting to see how, we talked about Alexander's education and the education that's often tied to these foundational or sacred texts, mm-hmm. such as the Hebrew Bible, or the Homeric epics, or the epic of Gilgamesh. But yes, we do have then slowly the emergence of educational institutions, first scribal schools that then draw larger parts of population of certain places. Certain places like Athens become much more literate than other places. What's fascinating to me, though, is that some of the fragments from early scribal schools, such as Egypt or Mesopotamia, we were talking about, again, 3,000-4,000 years ago,
right.
are often contain the following complaints by students about mean teachers. And of course, teachers saying this generation of students no longer cares about literature. They're only interested in I don't know what. They don't care about us anymore. It was all better when we were young. And so it's very funny. You know, 3,000-4,000 years old, and they could have been written yesterday.
That's so funny. That's great. Now, I was interested to read that the first sort of great novel that was written for a larger audience was written by a woman in Japan. She became known by the name of her protagonist, Murasaki, and this is in around the year 1000 Common Era. So I loved that was true. She was a lady-in-waiting at the Japanese court, which was also very interesting to me. And she chose to write about an earlier time period, I think to protect herself from the court's disapproval, because she was, in fact, writing about some of the things that go on at court. What would have been the reaction of that society to a woman introducing a new and powerful cultural phenomenon?
It was an unusual, in some sense, dangerous thing for her to do, starting with the fact that she had to basically acquire her literary education in secret, because this was not something that women were normally, even privileged women like she, minor aristocrats, were exposed to. So what she did was basically spy on her brother being tutored,
right.
and acquired her literary knowledge that way. So, I mean, it showed right from the beginning an incredible dedication and persistence and grit. And then when she acquired this position at court, she was in this great position to really observe the inner workings of this very closed, very secretive, and very exclusive court.
Yeah.
So this is what she did, and she started to write down scenes, individual chapters of what would become an over 1,000-page long novel. And what was so innovative about it is that she really wrote it in a new style that showed keen interest in motivation, in psychology, in minute signals and behavior and text, a richly textured kind of world of the court that she paints in minute details. All the things that we now associate and in some sense take for granted when we pick up a novel. And it's fascinating to see that, that she does that, that she pioneers a lot of it in this unusual situation. And one of the things that I spent a lot of time proselytizing for this novel is that I think we still in the West think of the novel often as a Western invention, as a Western export product. And it's true that later on in my story, the Western novel becomes a dominant of a genre and does get exported to the rest of the world, in part through the power of print. But there are these earlier moments, and The Tale of Genji is really a striking one, where that old story about the Western invention of the novel just isn't true. And I think we have to stop telling that story and appreciating the unusual creation of Murasaki Shikibu with The Tale of Genji is, I think, the best way of doing so.
Yeah, yeah. And you get to that also a little bit when you're talking about Goethe and his students' surprise at his wanting to read foreign texts. And I think to some extent, what we think of, the reason that we think of the novel as a Western phenomenon is because that's us. And of course, we created everything, right?
So. Exactly, exactly. Yes. I'm glad you mentioned Goethe because, yes, he coins the term world literature precisely because he realizes that the world of literature is much larger than what he had been told, contains so much more than what the Greek and Latin and European tradition that he had been exposed to contains. So he starts to get fascinated by the fact that he can now, for the first time, lay his hands on Chinese novels, on Persian poetry, on Sanskrit drama, and other literature from his perspective, far-flung places, and he realizes basically we need to change the way we think about literature, and the way we need to think about literature is world literature. And I think I've absorbed this and, in a sense, made that agenda, I think, my own, because we still are so hung up in a way on a Western canon. And, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with a Western canon. I teach a lot of Western literature. I write about Western literature in the book. But we really need to realize just how much more there is out there. So this is why in writing my book, I combine some well-known Western pieces of literature, such as Don Quixote and others, with texts that I think really need to be better known, such as The Tale of Genji, such as the Mayan epic Popol Vuh, or the West African epic of Sundiata among them. And so I think this Goethe idea of provocation of world literature is something that we can really still use. And as I said, I think I've sort of adopted it for myself as well.
Yeah. Well, I hate to do this now because I'm going to ask you about Don Quixote and I'm not asking you about the other ones. But when I was in college, I was a Spanish major and I had to read the original Don Quixote, which was hard, I'll be honest, but it was great. And I am curious, why do you suppose Cervantes so reviled the chivalric romance?
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting question. What's fascinating about Don Quixote is that we have here, almost for the first time, a piece of literature that's mostly dedicated to attacking a different kind of literature. Mm-hmm. So that alone is, I think, worth thinking about. It's in part a sign that by the time Cervantes comes along, the world of literature has really expanded and become so multi-layered, and in a way, you could almost say that from his perspective, the world has become saturated with all this literature, different kinds of literature. We are not longer talking just about the sort of important foundational texts, religious texts, but much more popular literature. So with that kind of popular literature rises opposition to literature, and often, especially popular literature, and often that opposition comes from sort of religious quarters, let's say priests or scribes charged with guarding and promoting sacred texts frown upon more popular literature, such as, for example, the Arabian Nights. But what's interesting about Cervantes is here that it comes from within the literary world, and he really wants to establish a new kind of storytelling, what we would then call the novel, against these chivalric romances. So putting down one kind of literature in order to promote another kind of literature.
Yeah.
That itself, it's kind of a new thing, and it's interesting. Now, about the particular reasons, you know, Cervantes would say that these chivalry romances construct a world that's unrecognizable, it's a sort of simple morality, that they have no relation to the real world. Now, of course, the idea that a novel should have, or piece of literature should represent reality in all its complexity is something that's also kind of a new idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not entirely new. We just talked about how Murasaki Shikibu really wanted to describe in great detail life at court in Kyoto, but it only becomes dominant step by step.
Right.
And this is something in part that Cervantes promotes, namely that literature needs to capture lived reality of the here and now and not draw us back into some kind of simple constructed world that never existed.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit of sort of genre snobbery, which we have now, but I don't see anybody writing against the romance or against the Western or against the thriller. So.
Well, but, you know, I think a lot of my colleagues frown upon, you know, and here again, new technologies make possible on Amazon these very specialized romances.
That's true.
You know, there's this whole ecosystem of very specialized romance writers who only write on Amazon but have these huge followings.
Yes.
And I think there are a lot of people in literature, in the publishing world, in academia, who look down on this new popular genre that's formulaic, that only caters to a very particular market, and so on and so forth. So I think there are probably a couple of Don Quixotes being written right now against them.
That's funny. Well, speaking of the internet, I wonder what you think Benjamin Franklin would think of the death of newspaper, which I know it's not dead, but we've seen a lot of newspapers fail as the digital age has moved forward. You know, he had a famous love for new technology, and yet he sort of established newspapers. So what do you think he would make of this?
Yeah, you know, I think he would embrace the new, because that's what he did in his time. And I think he was very savvy in recognizing what can be done with the technologies of his day, namely print. He heavily promoted newspapers and broadsheets, but he was also really interested in the whole technology side of it, or the infrastructure. He had control over paper mills. He even controlled the supply of rags out of which paper were made. He, of course, had a whole network of print shops. He owned newspapers and printed broadsheets. He even controlled the postal roads on which this printed material was distributed among the 13 colonies.
Right.
So he really assembled a media empire And that's what interested him. And all the way to much more specialized, what we would now call knowledge networks, when he, in his work as a scientist or natural philosophers, as they were called at the time. Here we're talking now about very specialized scholarly journals that emerged, what we now sometimes call the Republic of Letters, namely that there were these scientists in different countries who were basically working on a shared scientific or knowledge project. But all of this was made possible by this media empire that he assembled. And so I think when I look at Franklin, I see very much some combination of, I don't know, Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg. in that's the kind of thing he did.
Yeah.
He cared much more about it than about content.
Yeah. Now that's interesting. All right, Martin, I wanted to just switch gears a little bit and ask you what you're working on now. Are you writing a new book? Are you working on the Norton, update, or what are you doing?
Both, yeah. So we have been working on the Norton update. It's going to come out in the summer. And one of the things that we've been focusing on this time around is new translations. And the one I'm perhaps proudest of is that my classics editor on the Norton has been and continues to be Emily Wilson, and we commissioned that fantastic new translation of the Odyssey by her that came out in the fall and has made such big waves because it's such an unbelievably good translation of the Odyssey, so modern, so fast-moving, so clean in a way, so clutter-free, so unconvoluted, and it is also, shockingly, the first translation of the Odyssey into English by a woman. And so this is, in a sense, the highlight, perhaps, of this new edition, certainly of the classical part, but it's something that I'm very proud of to have been part of commissioning this great new translation that I really think will be the translation of a generation.
Yeah.
And so that's perhaps the most high-profile thing to emerge from this new edition of the Norton Anthology. But there are other exciting developments as well. We have much more Korean literature for the first time. We always add contemporary literature. The newest author, the newest edition, the author with whom we now conclude the anthology, the last volume, is Chimamanda Adichie, the Nigerian and now America-based writer, mm-hmm. whom I really love. So yes, there are lots of exciting new things in this new edition of the Norton Anthology.
Yeah, let me just ask you, how many languages do you speak, and how many languages do you read in?
Well, this is a good distinction you're making. So, I grew up speaking German. English now is my main language. I also grew up speaking some French. I studied in Italy, so I do have Italian. I do, though haltingly, read Spanish. I studied Greek and Latin, so once you have Latin, Italian, and French, you can sort of fake Spanish to some extent. I don't know whether you would agree with that.
No,
but
I think
you can
so.
Certainly passively read it I go to Latin America and try to pronounce a mixture of Italian and French in Spanish with a lisp. That doesn't always work so well, I have to admit. But reading works.
That's funny.
And I have some Yiddish, which perhaps can bring us to my current book project. But so I do have a number of languages, some of which I speak, some of which I read. But of course, with world literature, you have to go beyond that. So since we just talked about translation, I've become a big fan and promoter of translation. I think there are too many people in literature who are too focused on just reading in the original. I think you can get a lot out of a good translation, a lot of finely textured information about a culture and a place.
Yeah.
So, yes, I've spent a lot of time reading, learning different languages, and I love that. But I don't want to leave the impression on anyone, as some people do, that it's not worth reading literature in translation. It totally is.
Yeah. Okay. And what was your next project that you were talking about?
Yeah, so that's a very different and in some sense much quirkier project. It's a project about a secret language, a thief's language, a language of the underground that was spoken in Central Europe for a long time, from the late Middle Ages to the 20th century. And that secret language was a weird combination of German, Yiddish, and Hebrew. And it became kind of the lingua franca of the underground, a very peculiar and strange development. It was only a spoken language, but the police started to get suspicious about it and interested in it, and that's why there's sort of a written record of different police officers trying to decode and learn this underground language.
And does it have a name? Does the language have a name?
So it has two names. One name is Rotwelsch. So rot became a word for beggar. Welsh is a word that means Italian, but really it also means incomprehensible. So the incomprehensible cant of beggars, so a beggar's language.
Okay.
The other word is a Hebrew-derived name, Kashmir Lashon. Kashmir is derived from the Hebrew word for to know, and Lashon is the Hebrew word for language. So the language for those in the know, for the wise guys, so to speak. I prefer that second. So the language of the wise guys.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Wow. Yeah. Is it hard to find information?
It is hard to find information. However, not for me, because with some exaggeration, I can say that I grew up with this language.
Oh, interesting.
And not because I come from a family of notorious thieves. But because my uncle was obsessed with this language.
Oh.
He was on this one-man mission to rescue it from oblivion. So he was a writer. He started to incorporate it into his poetry. He started to translate bits of world literature into this thief's language to make it legitimate. And he died very early of a brain aneurysm. And I inherited his archive and have been carrying it around with me for 25 years. And of course, because of his obsession, he introduced, when I was growing up, this Rotwelsch language became sort of almost like a family shtick. We would bandy about words in it. Anyway, so from that early moment on, I was interested in, and when he died, I inherited his archive, and I've been sort of waiting for the moment to do something with it. And so this is what I'm doing now here at the New York Public Library. I'm writing a history of this language as a way into the hidden underground of Central Europe, but it's also connected to, in some sense, a family history, because I write about this uncle, how that language became part of my family. And also I found in doing this research that my grandfather was also, for different reasons, obsessed with this language.
Okay.
So weirdly entangled family history with this obscure language that almost no one knows about anymore. And so I'm trying to, I guess now I'm the last person, the most recent generation of my family trying to rescue this language from oblivion.
And nobody speaks it anymore, I take it.
No, I mean, again, with some exaggeration, you could say that I'm the last speaker.
Right, yeah. Now, so that reminds me, I was going to just mention, I suppose I'm making a little plug for this nonprofit organization in Burlington, Vermont, but there's a venture in Burlington called the Endangered Alphabets Project, which supports endangered minority and indigenous cultures by using their writing systems to create art. So the person who runs it is this man named Tim Brooks. He's been on the show before. He's a writer, but he creates furniture that has these beautiful languages carved or these beautiful alphabets carved into it. So I just was going to say that.
That sounds amazing. Tim Brooks. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, the Endangered Alphabets Project. It's very his, and he does beautiful work. Just so I'll put it out there.
Yeah.
Okay, so Martin, I just have a couple last questions for you. What are you reading lately that you might recommend to listeners? And I know you probably have to read so much for your work. Do you have anything that we haven't talked about that you've read lately that you would recommend?
Now let me think. What have I read recently that I recommend? Well, you know, because of my current project, I do read a lot of memoirs. One I really like that I've read recently is Susan Faludi's The Dark Room.
Oh, In the Dark Room, yeah.
In the Dark Room, which I think is just an amazing book.
Yes.
It's about her father, who is this Hungarian-American emigre who returns to Hungary. She's very estranged from him. He's sort of a strange figure. But all of a sudden, he decides to transition to woman. And so she starts to spend time with him to understand her father. And this whole world opens up in the process, in this very complicated, very emotionally fascinating relationship between daughter and father emerges.
And it is very fascinating because she is, of course, a very well-known feminist, and I think that a lot of her original ideas were influenced by the fact that she grew up with this very sort of, I think, macho father who was...
Yes.
Yeah. And
kind of a family, this kind of pedantic family tyrant.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Okay. Yeah, that's a great book to recommend. So I have one last question for you, Martin. I always end by asking a sort of targeted question about advice for writers, because my show is for writers as well as readers. And your book is a book that could be used in the classroom. The Written World is a book that could be used in the classroom, and yet it is very far from a dry textbook. I just want to mention in reviews and coverage, it's been called gripping, spellbinding. My favorite was intellectual athleticism. and it's so apt because I feel like a book about great literature should be closer to literature than it is to, say, like a lecture. So I wonder if you have any advice for writers who are working on scholarly nonfiction for keeping it engaging, because this book reads like literature.
I'm glad you said what you just said, and it was one ambition, and was precisely for the reason you mentioned that I felt like here I was trying to promote this literature, to write about it, to write about the story of literature, and it seemed like I really should absorb some of the lessons of great literature for my own writing, and I'm glad you think that I succeeded.
It
was
definitely
really very important for me to do that. As I said, it was because I want to really. There is sort of a hidden proselytizing ambition here to really entice people into reading some of the texts that they may not have heard of in the book, and maybe to rediscover texts they already knew. I think that you know, writers of nonfiction, people who write about literature, should not be afraid to tell stories themselves. I mean, this is ultimately what we do, and it's a pity that my profession, literary criticism, has tended to forget that. I think sometimes out of a misconceived idea of, I, the scholar, need to be completely separate from the object of study, so to speak. I need to be the scientist with the pointer and the, you know, and not confuse me with the writer. I think I think there is a sense of, we need to keep this distance, that has led some critics who write about literature from being willing to learn some lessons from great storytellers, mm-hmm. and to apply them to their own writing. So yes, I do want to encourage that. I also hope with the book to influence fiction writers. Not that I think that they can learn great lessons from my own writing, but I want to encourage them to read, because I think that great writers need to be great readers. Mm. And I do think that our current MFA programs sometimes tend to approach writing too much as a kind of technical skill that you learn. And they don't, in my mind, make students of MFA programs, budding writers, read enough and read widely enough. Mm-hmm. And so that's maybe when it comes to advice for writers, I want to encourage them to read world literature widely, to not read just the narrow canon of literature that is gets promoted in our current set of sort of elite MFA programs. I mean, I sometimes teach students from these MFA programs. I don't want to sound too critical. I think they do what they do very well, but it sometimes it feels to me a little narrow in mm-hmm. the kind of scope that they offer students. So this would be my other plug.
Okay. Well, that's great. All right. Wonderful. Well, Martin, I want to thank you very much for speaking with me today. And I'll just reiterate, the name of your book is The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization by Martin Puchner and published by Random House. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sheila. This was a great, wonderful conversation. Thank you for all your questions and thoughts.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Martin Puchner. We discussed his new book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization, published by Random House. You can learn more about his work at martinpuchner.com. What is one of the earliest legends you remember coming across? Was it a biblical story, such as that of Cain and Abel? Was it a story of Ulysses or Odysseus, whichever, perhaps in a form published for children? Or maybe it was the Thousand and One Nights. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider an early legend that had an effect on you and write with that story in mind. Perhaps write a contemporary take on the story itself, or give consideration to the moral of the tale, if there was one, and write in an effort to share the same ethical lessons. You could also research the ways in which that early legend might have influenced historical events and write about that. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.